Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Carol Harnett, and I am president of the Council for Disability Awareness, and this is another episode of the Financial Health and Income Network. I am so pleased to introduce actually my guest host, who is also my colleague, Fred Schott. Fred is our research consultant at the CDA, the Council for Disability Awareness. You'll hear both terms. And he'll be interviewing today one of our board members, Ian Bridgman. Ian is the founder and principal at the Claim Lab, and he has been on our show before and has actually written several blog posts for us. So just delighted to have both of these gentlemen here. And we were just talking a little bit today about what, you know, what is Ian's, you know, points that he'd love to discuss. And it's a lot of it's around new pandemic data, including the impact on mental health and psychosocial factors, and even the ramifications the pandemic's had on how claims are processed and claims operation and the cost of ignoring psychosocial issues. So with no further ado, I am going to turn this over to Fred. And right before I do that, I'm going to send a reminder that we do transcribe all of our podcasts in a highlighted transcript, so it is not the full 30 minutes. And we run that on the Council for Disability Awareness blog, which can be found at the URL blog.disabilitycanhappen.org. So thank you, Fred, and thanks for taking over the show.
You're welcome, Carol. This is great. Recently I've been converting what used to be my office into a guest room, and I've moved my work-related stuff down to a finished basement area. And looking through some materials earlier, I noticed an old two-volume set of disability duration guidelines that I made frequent use of in an old job a long time ago. And this is 2005 that these came out. And what kind of struck me recently, I was just looking at the preface in there. It was something that said, in recent years, the disability paradigm has begun to shift. The traditional medical thinking that recovery from illness or injury requires rest and withdrawal from work is becoming passé. It is rapidly being replaced by the idea that people recover better and faster if they stay active and engaged in life as much as possible during and after the medical episode. A growing body of medical evidence supports this new approach. And in this guideline set, there were like numerous conditions in there and a table of expected duration. How long should they last, and variability of durations based on the kind of work. Now, interestingly, the kind of work is it sedentary, is it light, medium, heavy, very heavy, based on the physical demands of the job. And that's pretty much it. Now, fast forward to within the last year, I also revisited a paper that one of our CDA research committee members, Carrie Wisner from MD Guidelines, was the lead author on, and also the physician who chaired the medical advisory board for these disability guidelines was a co-author as well. They had way more factors and conditions that can influence somebody's success in getting back to life, back to work, including, you know, their levels of anxiety, worry, whether they were getting adequate social support, how they felt about their job, really addressing psychosocial factors to a much greater degree than was the case in the early 2000s, all, again, in support of getting people back to work and back to life. So that was very interesting and revelatory in terms of the way things have evolved over time. And one of the challenges has always been, well, you know, how do you measure these psychosocial factors and how do you work that into the disability claim management process? And that is where my guest today, Ian Bridgman, the head of the Claim Lab and a member of the CDA Board of Directors and a CDA member company, has some phenomenal insights to offer. So, Ian, why don't I have you tell the audience about how you've approached the challenge of measuring and tracking psychosocial factors in the claims management process.
Yeah, sure, Fred, and hello, everybody. Yeah, it's been an interesting journey for us because we came at this from a very much a statistical modeling point of view. We started off building predictive models to model the recovery, the duration of a claim, of a short-term disability or a long-term disability claim, and trying to project from some pretty basic set of data what the duration of that claim would be. So in other words, you could identify the high-risk claims and focus on those. And what we found was that it wasn't enough just to look at the basic data that an insurance company would provide us with. And you know that sort of stuff. It's what comes from the policy administration system or the claims system. And there's a little bit of medical data there as well. Maybe you've got a diagnosis code, perhaps a primary and a secondary codes there. But really, when you started looking at the profile of claims, there was something we were missing. When the claim got more complex, our accuracy got way off. It was much harder to predict those long-duration claims than it was the short-duration stuff. And we sort of were trying to work out why this would be. And of course, we speak to people in claims operations and they say, oh, well, of course, you'd never understand that because it's all those other factors, all those psychosocial factors. And it's like, well, okay, tell us more. How do we understand these psychosocial factors? How do we quantify those? And that was really the start of the journey. It was actually to try and build better predictive models and provide better data to analyze and to predict what's going to happen on claims. So we set about this process of trying to untangle this stuff that we'd never be able to understand with some help from some behavioral psychologists and some really smart data people and some software engineers as well, so we could actually build an application out of it. And basically what we saw was that there were a number of factors which really drove the duration of the claim. I'm not for a moment maligning the medical diagnosis, because clearly that's a major, major important factor. But it's not the only one. Mental health was a huge issue. We saw the duration of the claims being driven tremendously by the level of depression or anxiety that the employee, the claimant, would be suffering from. And that might be something that wasn't even on the claim form. It's something, if you like, an undocumented mental health episode. And why should people not tell us that they're depressed or anxious? Well, it's all in that workplace situation issue. The fact that, these policies are owned by their employers, they're paid for by an employer, so why would they turn around and say, actually, I can't work anymore because I'm feeling really depressed, I hate my job, I hate my boss, I'm very anxious, when it's perhaps easier to say, actually, I sprained my back at the weekend and it's I don't want to talk about it, it's very sore, And we saw this repeatedly in the data, where there was a physical diagnosis on the claim form, but when you looked at the profile of the data we were getting from the psychosocial analysis, it was something very different. And how did we get that data? Well, we used self-reported questionnaires. So we structured and built questionnaires that the claimant, the employee, would fill out, and then we would analyze. And we've seen some really great stuff coming out of this. As we start to accumulate more and more data, of course, it takes us in some interesting directions. So it's been quite a journey for us.
Mm. So give us an example of a kind of psychosocial measure that you would track and how that works, just for the sake of illustration.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that the three top measures that we follow, there are others, but the three top ones are mental health, workplace issues, and individual motivation. And in that situation, people, if they're depressed or anxious, they're going to take them longer to get back to work. So you go off with a rotator cuff injury or whatever it might be, but then you've got an underlying depression and anxiety issue. Or you don't like your job, you hate your boss, the workplace issue. Or the motivation thing, typically on the sort of lower paid workers, where perhaps they haven't got a high drive factor, and you know, perhaps they're getting 60%, 70% of their earnings on disability. Well, you know, maybe it's just too easy just to stay on disability.
So it sounds like this kind of information is, you know, given the last couple of years, and even pre-pandemic, this was the case, where employers wanted to get some more insights into the overall well-being and health of their workforce and their employees, and how does that, you know, lead to, you know, to better productivity and so forth and so on. It sounds like this is a way also of providing some supplementary insights into, you know, what's going on in the workforce, and, you know, taking the temperature of the workforce beyond just the presenting physical issues. Does that sound right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, you have. It has tremendous potential to actually measure the temperature of what's going on. And I suppose, you know, unlike you might find in a sort of an employee assistance program, what we can look at is obviously we're sitting on top of actual disability claim information. So we can see, okay, this sort of profile individual or this sort of situation is likely to result in this sort of profile claim. And we can see that because we have the data.
Now, this is something you were you had built out and implemented, and we're starting to get functioning in the pre-2020 period. Is that correct, if I, you know, remember correctly from our previous conversations on this?
Yes, our early projects really started in the sort of the middle of 2019. Yes.
Okay. So you kind of had the ability to have some pre-pandemic baseline data, and then to see what happened to these measures during the pandemic. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what you were seeing there.
Yeah, that was a bit of a surprise, actually, because, you know, we weren't expecting that. But, you know, when it was actually the beginning of this year, when we were doing some research for one of our clients, and we were just looking back at, you know, we basically plot, we have this metric which plots claim severity. So we look at a whole load of factors which influence the overall severity of a block of claims. And if you track that month by month, basically it gives you an interesting indicator as to, you know, how complex or not your claims are on a month-by-month basis, for staff purposes and staffing and so forth, and just to give the actuaries some help in terms of potential reserving and so on. But we were doing this analysis, and it was really interesting, plotting this month-by-month, going back over that pandemic period. There was what emerged was a plateau in the severity scores from the beginning of the pandemic through to about a 12-month period ongoing. And that all the scores was just that bit higher over that whole period. And it sort of set us thinking of, why? What the hell's going on here? And, of course, you think about what we're measuring. We're looking at anxiety. We're looking at workplace issues. We're looking at domestic issues. We're looking at all those things that go into the melting pot when, you know, someone's looking at their well-being, their state of mind. And these were becoming factors on the claim duration. So, you know, and you know, you imagine the scenario. You get someone who goes off work with the infamous rotator cuff injury, and but now we're in the pandemic. So whereas perhaps before they'd have had some sort of motivation to get back to work and everything was good, now you've got those other things working on them. So perhaps they've got perhaps their employer isn't taking proper precautions with masks and so forth. Perhaps they've got elderly parents that they're trying to support. And, you know, maybe those factors just make it people less inclined to want to go back to work. And we saw an overall increase in these severity factors right across the board.
So, and again, by severity factors, you're talking about, again, these, you know, psychosocial factors of the person's underlying, you know, mental well-being, their attitudes towards work, and also just the indication of their, you know, what is it that individually motivates them, right?
Exactly.
You know,
yep.
your three common sets. Yeah. So,
yes,
those in a way were... you know, kind of emergent and revealed, you know, barriers to getting people back to work. Again, there's more going on here than just, making sure that the underlying, you know, physical condition or whatever that presented itself has been resolved. There's, you know, some of these other dynamics. Yeah. So
and this isn't new. This has been going on for years. You know, people have been saying, you know, don't over-medicalize claims. And this is the whole point about it. You've got to not focus on the medical condition. You've got to not focus on managing the claim because it's a rotator cuff claim or it's a lower back claim or whatever else it might be. You've got to look at wider than that because we can see that those wider influences really do have a dramatic effect on the claim duration.
Mm. And, you know, interestingly that you mentioned that there's and I'll do this, you know, when I provide the show notes or the transcript for our conversation here, that that article that, you know, I had shared with you, the one where Kerry Wisner was the lead author, and actually an article for the I believe one of the professional academies for family medicine specialists. So, you know, family medicine being where most of us have, you know, our encounters, our greatest encounters with the health system, offering some, you know, guidance and insight into, you know, how to address the issue of work disability. And there's a fascinating graphic in there showing all of the various factors that come into play in contributing to I believe they call it a work-life disruption event, which is really what, you know, work disability is. And it gets very much at what you were talking about just now. So you have, you know, this is a framework that you provide for your clients, right?
Right, yep.
Yeah, okay. Insurers and third-party administrators and the like, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know we're still in its infancy. We're still sort of exploring this, you know, because it's great to have the opportunity to open up about, a little bit about it, and of course the real issue is, okay, so you identify a workplace issue or you identify a mental health issue. The thing then is, what do you do about it? How do you actually help that person? What tools have we got in our box of claim managers to say, how do we help this person that hates their job, that, you know, has depression, that's got a complicated family situation or whatever else it might be? How do we actually help them? And, you know, I think this is, we're lucky enough to do a lot of work in Canada, and the Canadians, because of different perhaps employment laws and legislation around how they treat disability, they have to go a lot further down the line, down the road of actually providing interventions, providing a sort of fuller return to work service than perhaps we see generally with the insurers in the U.S. And I think this is something that's, you know, I don't know, perhaps I'm being overdramatic, but I think, you know, I like to think that highlighting these issues and things like what's happened across the pandemic will help to change attitudes of insurers to step up and provide more. Maybe it's a competitive advantage issue when they're selling their services to employers to say, you know, we'll take it a whole lot further than perhaps the rest of the industry does. I don't know.
So yeah, it does sound like this pushes things in the direction of providing disability coverage that goes beyond just, you know, well, just, and I don't want to sound like I'm downplaying that, because it's an extremely important and essential service, and that is providing the income replacement, but not necessarily stopping, not just stopping at the income replacement, right? Sounds almost like the equivalent of, you know, making sure that, you know, if we're getting somebody back into a context, that they have the appropriate, you know, additional supports, not just financial, but non-financial supports as well, to help them succeed in their return to the environment.
Yes, exactly.
Almost like I think back to this is like it's going on 10 years now that I got involved in my mom's care, and she had been hospitalized for, you know, a number of things, but before they discharged her, they they sent out a team to her apartment to scope out, you know, did she have, was the environment she was returning to a safe and appropriate environment? And it's almost kind of like a similar analogy there, you know, taking a look at what kind of an environment are people going back to, and can they do so in a safe and healthy fashion? Very interesting. Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, pandemic, obviously an uptick in the complexity of claims and the like. What are we seeing, you know, what are you starting to see now in the, you know, the current phase? There's a lot of talk around the lines of, you know, yeah, we're entering into the endemic phase of this this whole situation where, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, it's going to be around and we need to learn how to manage it. But, you know, how is that manifesting itself in some of these indicators that you're seeing?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that all the indicators are fortunately trending downward. So, you know, are we returning to normal? You know, I don't know quite sure what normal is these days. I mean, I don't know about you personally, but, you know, I've been working now for 3 years from home, and I've lost all my desire to climb on an aeroplane and travel anywhere, to conferences or business appointments or whatever. You know, we've survived for 3 years without going anywhere, so why should I put myself through that indignity of traveling on an aeroplane and wait the time it wastes? So, you know... You know, I used to have a case in my bedroom ready to go. You know, had all everything I needed in there. I don't have that anymore. And, I'm going on a trip on Sunday and I'm dreading it. I've got to pack my case from scratch. You know, and it's going to take a while to get us back there, if we ever get back to the same place. We're perhaps in some sort of PTSD phase, post pandemic PTSD or something. I don't know. It's
Well, interestingly that you mentioned that there is, and I mentioned this on the last podcast we did about the post-pandemic, you know, adjustment disorder, whatever. There actually is an ICD code for that. I kind of had facetiously said on LinkedIn that, if there's a code for it, then, you know, then it's real. You know, somebody had mentioned that as a condition. And it turns out, you know, one of the people in my network had said, yeah, it turns out that there is a specific code associated with that. So, you know, the fact is we've been through a lot, and you know that needs to be again that needs to be taken into account, and it has a bearing on you know people's ability to recover from one of these disruptive episodes. Yeah.
Well, and we're reading more and more information about the young people who are joining the workforce now, who have got this very different perspective on life to everybody else. Well, maybe everyone else is actually catching them up. You know, the work-life balance is being reassessed. And maybe that's a good thing. You know, maybe it's forcing us to have a closer look at how we conduct our lives and interact with our families. You know, there may be some good to come out of all this.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Broadening the or zooming out on the lens to take a look at the larger context of people's lives, and I think that's an important takeaway for, you know, anybody who is interested in or concerned about or, you know, following the whole issue of work-related disability. And, you know, clearly the interplay of, mental health as a comorbidity factor with, non-mental health disability, that, you know, that's an area that is getting more and more attention, as you know, no doubt, from the work that the CDA Research Committee did a few years ago on taking a look at the database and the linkages between mental health conditions and physical disabilities, the one that when Fraser Gasper was on the committee that he spearheaded and actually turned into an article for the Journal of Environmental and Occupational Medicine. Very, very interesting and informative insights about the significant role that mental health comorbidities can play in the disability process. So that's good. So, Ian, I'm keeping an eye on my kitchen timer here. let me ask you, you know, is there something that, you know, that we haven't talked about in this conversation that you think we should have or that you'd like to, you know, bring to the fore?
Yes, I think there's probably one more aspect to it that sort of really gives it some teeth, if you like, because, you know, as we've been accumulating more data and we're looking at, you know, claims where there's psychosocial issues that complicate recovery and those claims where there isn't, you know, same medical condition, same sort of profile claimant, and looking at the recovery profiles for those two individuals, you know, we can really start to see now there's a significant, we can really quantify the factor of psychosocial, whether it was driven by mental health or whatever. And we're seeing, you know, that there is now a real cost to ignoring psychosocial issues. And I'm not saying for one moment that we can completely eliminate the effect of recovery, what the psychosocial has on recovery. But what we can do is become more aware of it, and we can make our process, our return to work plan for those individuals more sophisticated. And we can now start to say, okay, there is a real cost of not acting on psychosocial. You know, you can approach it from two ways. You can either say, okay, all right, we know this is going to be a complex claim. Let's put it down this high-touch process to make sure that we cover off these complicating factors. Or if we just ignore it, we turn around and we're left surprised by, oh, why did this claim last so long? What was different about this one? You know? So I think we're starting to get some teeth on this now, and you know I think it's all in the data, Fred.
Yeah. So you know, bottom line there again, cost to, you know, obviously to plan sponsors, disability plan sponsors, but also cost to the individual workers in terms of, you know, their delayed process of getting back to health, back to, you know, back to work, back to life. It all, you know, it all adds up. That's that's a good point.
Yeah, and,
all
and
right.
it's very simple. We've got to treat the whole person, you know.
And that's that's been a theme of our last couple of conversations, and we may want to, you know, we'll definitely want to continue to build that out. So, Ian, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining us on this discussion, and for our listeners. Again, as Carol had mentioned at the outset, what we do is we'll provide an annotated transcript or edited transcript of the highlights of this talk, along with all kinds of supplementary materials in the links. And look for that in the next 1 to 2 weeks at blog.disabilitycanhappen.org. That's disability can happen. That's all one. So blog.disabilitycanhappen.org. And on that note, I would like to thank you again, Ian, and thank our listening audience. And we'll talk to you again.
Fred, thank you very much.
Financial Health. Okay. And Information Network. Okay, Ian. Bye-bye.